On the question of sila, I'm used to thinking of sila as abstention, wiriti, but understand it has a positive aspect as well. Could you say something about that, please?
Sila is the deeds and speech conditioned by citta. So it depends on citta. When citta is at kusala, the speech and deeds are at kusala, unwholesome sila. So there is also kusala sila. When kusala citta arises, it's not just abstention from your deeds, but it's also the act or the deeds of helping or doing something for the others. And apayagata sila for arahata, because they still do have deeds and speech.
The acts of helping others do something with kusala, that would constitute the positive aspect of sila. There would also be some other kind of kusala as well, to
many
be
levels
many levels.
Yeah. When there is understanding or awareness of seeing, there is no ill deeds. And that's also indriya samvara sila, not just only ordinary sila.
So could we say it's seeing other forms of kusala as sila?
When there is the understanding of reality, there can be many aspects of describing realities.
So in the case of right livelihood, which we were discussing yesterday, were you suggesting that some kusala deeds can be seen as right livelihood?
It's not just wanting to name or to call anything, like whether it is sama ajiva or not. But when there is awareness and understanding of reality, realities are different. Mm-hmm. That's why there are so many, many words for each different ones. So it cannot be pinpoint whether at this moment it is sama ajiva or right livelihood, or when citta is kusala, and then by understanding the difference of levels of cetasikas, then one know at that particular moment whether it is samma kammanta or samma vajjara or samma ajiva. Otherwise, it's like trying so hard to know it when it does not appear at all, thinking and thinking over it.
I always thought in the suttas, for example, or in the texts I've read, that whenever it refers to right livelihood, it's something in the course of one's work, and this is why they talk about certain kinds of work not being suitable, not killing or not trading in weapons or something like this. But you were saying it refers to living, not livelihood. So is that correct?
Does that depend also on living?
Well, presumably it does, but I'm just interested in that. So it means any
that arises at the very moment.
Yes.
One can see, but now it's impossible to know. But when it's there, since there's no understanding, there's knowing about it. So it cannot be told until then, when citta arises with sampajanya and it can understand realities better and better.
And in the example you gave about taking food that you don't like that's good for your health, well, what difference does it make in that example whether it's food you don't like or you do like?
One just cannot take the example, but in one's life what happens? By understanding Dhamma, then one begins to know what is what. It's not just take it and find out, but it's the understanding of realities will condition understanding reality right then.
But I wondered why you gave in that example, why you particularly said, oh, taking food one doesn't like. Why in your example did you not say taking food one does like? What's the difference?
Situation.
Just a different situation, but it could be either.
Anytime anything happens, there must be citta cetasikas. And it's impossible just to tell, because there is no understanding of citta and cetasika as they are yet. It's only thinking about whether it's this or it's that.
I think yesterday the fact that it was something you didn't like pointed out the fact that it was for livelihood, for living. You know, normally we take food that we like anyway, it's easy, but to take it because we don't like it.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
You're only taking it for living,
keeping
not
alive.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when we refer to the verities, for example, the moment of abstaining from harsh speech or the moment of abstaining from harmful action as a path factor, it doesn't seem at that moment that there's any right understanding of reality. Now, I know we've discussed before, we don't have to pinpoint exact moment or whatever, but what we generally think of in terms of moments of abstention from harmful speech or action or livelihood doesn't seem to have anything much to do with the right understanding of reality. Where is the correlation?
It's the maka. It's maka. So it has to be there along with it.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes though the scriptures say that right livelihood, he abstains from, you know, killing, or he abstains from so on as right livelihood, or he's they have a very conventional ideas about right livelihood, like not raising animals and things like that, that they talk about as right livelihood, but like Sarah said, it doesn't seem necessarily related to, it's so conventional. How do we relate it to paramattha?
What jitta is there?
Well, I mean, there can be people who are not Buddhist who see the value of not doing those sort of jobs.
Everyone must have jitta and jitta-sika, not just the Buddhist.
So they can have right livelihood too?
Anyone according to Dhamma. Dhamma doesn't belong to just a name.
Okay, but don't we say that right livelihood should be, if it's part of the path, it should come with punya?
Concerning living.
Does it have to...
For living, or just kill for fun, or just kill...
Okay, when someone who's not Buddhist abstains from killing...
Why do we have to say Buddhist?
Because I'm thinking of the Eightfold Path is with right understanding.
The person who kills, a Buddhist kill and an Islam kill, no different.
But an Islamic person cannot have right view, right?
Different moment.
But if they are having
a jhana seeker, right livelihood, that's just a jhana seeker.
But don't we also say that right livelihood always comes with right understanding because it's first on the path?
That's just a path factor. But the jhana seeker, right livelihood, there are three jhana seekers.
Okay, so you can have right livelihood without panya. That's what I'm trying to ask. You can. People can do it.
So basically we're talking about different degrees and kinds of right livelihood then, because some are bija, which may or may not be a path factor, or may or may not be accompanied with the development of satipatthana.
When Buddha taught us about citta and jetasikas in details for 45 years, did he want us to experience all of them? As he knew, or as he had experienced, or just let anyone who know about it understand oneself, how much one can understand thoroughly, or just some part of in a day, is there any understanding at all, or just remember the word and the term?
I mean, it's actually the same with any right speech or speech or right action. There can be some are bhachi and some are kamanta, which isn't path factor.
That's what I'm trying to clarify. It can be without, it's not perfect.
And so would you like to know whether now it's right speech? Yes. Or just talk about right speech?
Right.
Both?
Just to clarify the texts on this point, I find it a little bit confusing.
Is that the Buddha's purpose to want us to just being able to classify as much as he taught for 45 years, all of them?
It's useful in the sense that we don't want to mislead other people or ourselves on what the Buddha meant.
Being so keen in knowing how to classify but not understanding reality at all.
Oh, that's true.
Well, if we come back to this moment and write speech at this moment, we can't say just generally, even with talking about Dharma, we can't say generally, oh, this is right speech, because it just depends on the citta from moment to moment. Yeah. There are moments one's talking about Dharma, but actually one's a little bit anxious, and then it's not kusala, so it just depends on each.
One can see that how little one really has understanding of reality, but one expects to know everything which cannot be known from book. Like now, whether it is right speech, what kind of citta is there, see? We just know the word.
You keep saying what kind of citta is there, but mm-hmm. this gets back to one's understanding of the mm-hmm. nature of the citta of the
reality
present moment.
Right now, right. Not just to understand the word.
Yes.
Yeah, but the reality right now.
Yes, but one's understanding of the nature of the reality right now is very weak.
So how can there be more understanding, not just by classifying?
Yes, good question.
The more we know the point of study, to understand reality right now.
We'd like to understand the reality right now.
We would like, because it's attachment. See, but to understand, when does attachment come? Maybe all day, but not knowing or understanding as a very dangerous reality, because it can arise safely anytime, any moment.
If there is no sense of the nature of the present reality right now, despite the fact that it's what we're talking about, would that be ignorance? Would that be a sign of ignorance?
No understanding. Who knows that now, at this moment of seeing this, already akusala, before knowing who's who, or what's what.
We understand that to be the case, but we don't have direct knowledge of that akusala. There's just a lack of that developed understanding that can know anything more about the present citta. So that must be then the characteristic of ignorance that is appearing.
I think that by knowing that now there are realities which are known to Panya, the more we know about reality right now, it can be conditioned for understanding. Because some people in the day just want to think about Satipatthana. It strikes their interest, this word Satipatthana. But what reality is now appearing? No attention, no more understanding, just wanting how to have Satipatthana. So just leave all those words and understand that what is not known now is Panya. And is it right to understand reality right now as Dhamma? Even if it's so not clear, but the more there is understanding that it's now appearing unknown with Panya, the more there is the understanding of it. Just like now, see, do not get away from this, even if it's not clear, but that can be the beginning of knowing, understanding it as just a reality which can be seen. That's all in samsara that one clings to so much from life to life. But by understanding it, it will be less and less object of attachment, but very gradually. Otherwise, there's none at all. It takes time to all realities like hardness or thinking. Otherwise, when there can be awareness even in between, without attachment, that shows that one is improved by having more understanding of realities.
Yesterday, I'm prompted in the afternoon, you brought up the topic of breath. I'm wondering whether you had any reason for bringing it up in particular.
because usually it's a topic that only comes up when someone asks about it, but yesterday it was the topic that you introduced. Any reason?
Just happened.
Just conditions.
Yeah. Sometimes when we read, we think that we understand, but it's not like when reality appears at all. For example, who doesn't know what breath is? Anyone can say. But what is the reality of breath, and how can it appear? Not with intention or selection at all. So by this way, one begins to understand the conditions for each moment or each reality, because each one is so short, just arise and falls away. When there is no awareness, it's gone completely. Nothing is left at all. But there shouldn't be thinking too much about that which has gone. What about the understanding of reality right now? And one can understand one's accumulation, even to be aware of this or that, not at one's will. Seeing anatta better and better, more and more. As one used to say, all dharmas are anatta. It should conform with reality right now.
Seeing experiences as anatta adds to the understanding of them as being dhamma, as against feeling being my feeling. When it arises and we know that it's conditioned, because that's the nature of all dhammas, so we develop more understanding of what dhamma is. Is that it?
Yes, but when one says that it's conditioned, there's no understanding of any reality yet.
Mm.
It has to be right at the moment when awareness is aware of a reality, and no thinking. But no one can stop thinking. But one can see the difference between moment of being aware and moment of thinking. And if one thinks that it's conditioned, no one can stop such thinking. But the more there is awareness of a characteristic of a reality, one can see the distinction between reality and concept. And one knows that concept is just object of thinking. It's not as real as a characteristic which is now appearing. So what should be the object of understanding?
Really?
Not only the concept, but the reality which has its characteristic. And if there is no awareness, everything is gone. So fast.
What do you mean everything is gone?
Everything. Visible object, sound, thinking, cetasikas, citta.
But whether there's awareness or not, it's the same, isn't it?
Yes, but when there is awareness, it begins the understanding of a characteristic, as we used to say, dhamma.
Just coming back to breath for a moment, usually we say that in the development of right understanding, the development of satipatthana, well, all that's experienced through the body sense is tangible object, and it doesn't matter in the slightest whether it's this hardness or that hardness or this temperature or this or that one, because Patui just has the characteristic of Patui, Tejo just has the characteristic of Tejo, regardless of whether it's strong or mild or rough or smooth or whatever the characteristic is. So we don't have to identify, oh, this is the hardness of body or this is the hardness of table, because it's just that characteristic, and as Sukhin was saying yesterday. But yet you stress quite a lot that, well, when it's breath, it's particular tangible object, particular kind of patui, particular kind
of... I said that that is the reality of what we call breath.
Right, yes. But I think my question is, what does it matter? Because if it's still just hardness or temperature that's experienced through the body sense, even if it's the most subtle one, or even if it's never experienced or is experienced, it's still just that characteristic of hardness or just that characteristic of temperature. So why does it matter, or why do you emphasize that that's a particular one, that is breath?
So we'll talk just about the four primary rupas, nothing else.
We come to know what we used to take for breath is just that.
Mm-hmm.
And no, like you were saying yesterday, nobody can stop memory, nobody can stop thinking that follows. So the thinking follows the experience of hardness. And at that moment, there's the understanding that, oh, what we used to take was as breath was just these elements.
And also, I think that what the other reason I assume that you're stressing this is so that people understand that what they take for being understanding or experience of breath isn't breath at all, because we think that, oh, you know, the motion in the abdomen or the experiencing at the nostril is the experience of breath, but actually these are just coarse rupas being experienced through the body sense. Asita gave the example of experiences in the body, and you said, well, yes, this isn't breath, but even when people experience some flow of air through the nostrils, I think you would say this is not anapanasati, this is not the breath the Buddha talked about. So the answer is that no one knows or experiences
until
breath.
Until it appears.
And it only appears through
panya,
through development of panya.
But a person who understands that what is taken for breath is just the primary rupas may still nonetheless develop samatha with breath as object. So in that sense, we'll
conventional breath or breath itself, which is conditioned by citta.
Well, that would have to be breath, which is conditioned by citta.
For samatha?
Yes.
Yeah.
No,
for samatha. Samatha does not understand reality.
One of the arguments I've heard from people who do meditation, say they try to concentrate on the four elements these days or so on, they say they know it's probably with a kusala, but they like training sanya so that later when kusala, if kusala moments come in, there's more conditioned to just be aware of paramatta. So they try to be aware of paramatta, even though they know most of the time it's akusala, they're just having lobha, but there's still sanya there or something. And eventually they're hoping that that intention to be aware of paramatta dharma, if there is moments of kusala coming in, there's more chance because they've trained the mind in some way to often be aware of paramatta just with sanya, even though it's akusala. So that's one of the arguments they use to say it's not so bad to try to be aware of paramatta in that way.
So what's the purpose of training sanya?
Just that they think when moments of kusala do arise by the right conditions.
How do they know that it's moments of kusala?
They don't really. Don't.
They don't. So what's the purpose of training sanya?
Well, I think that's their opinion, yeah.
No understanding.
It's like saying, okay, I'll postpone understanding now, and later it might happen. As if there can't be any understanding.
It's like the argument they give about having attachment in order to get rid of attachment, that kind of.
The idea of practice makes perfect as well, that they try a few different variations, and eventually they hope to stumble onto the right way, I guess. Yeah.
Accidentally?
By saying no now, it won't be yes later.
Yeah, I think it's also the idea that they're having less degrees of akusala, like by trying to...
Akusala all the way along.
But it's like, by trying to be aware of paramatta dharma, they're not having the gross akusala or dosa, gross lopa.
They don't mind the avijja.
They don't mind the avijja, they don't mind the subtle.
So as long as there is avijja, there must be akusala.
If it's wrong view, how can the wrong view lead to right view?
that it's an idea of somehow self being aware or controlling the dharmas, how can that wrong view suddenly be any part of any path towards right view?
It all comes down to wrong understanding at a pariyati level, no understanding.
That's why satyajnana is very important. Without satyajnana, there will never be the enlightenment at all. Thinking about the accumulation of kusala of Sariputta, how long, but in one life, he had become Sotapanna and Arhata later. So long accumulation of understanding as satyajnana.
This touches on sila. I'd like to come back a little bit to the Visuddhis we were discussing the other day, and I just read this out partly for Sukhin. There are six mundane stages of purification preceding and culminating in the seventh supramundane stage of purification. These six stages are an expanded version of the more common threefold division of the preliminary path into virtue, concentration, and wisdom. The seventh stage is the attainment of the supramundane paths. In the six mundane stages of purification, the 37 requisites of enlightenment are found in various combinations according to circumstances. That's a note in CMA. These six visuddhis, we know they develop with Satipatthana, and in this sense, it is the gradual development of the enlightenment factors which will eventually realize the seventh supramundane visuddhi. Now, as we said, the third visuddhi is Namarupa Paricheda Jnana, the first stage of insight. And the first visuddhi before that, which is Sila Visuddhi, is the purification of Sila with Satipatthana. However, I just don't understand how one can refer to the purification of Sila at that stage, which is, even though Satipatthana is being developed, it's not yet the first Vipassana Jnana. And usually we refer to purification of Sila, Adi Sila, at the moment of enlightenment, which would be the seventh visuddhi. Does it mean, rather than purification of Sila, does it mean purification of Sila, meaning that Sila is beginning to purify because Satipatthana is developing? Is that what it means? Not that Sila is purified in any way, but just that it is beginning to purify?
As it's understood by the Panya as the self.
Right. So it is, we could say, the beginning of the path of purification of Sila. So it's not actually purification, but the development of purification of Sila.
Otherwise, how can Sila be Visuddhi without any understanding?
It can't. So it's not suggesting that Sila is purified in any way at that level. It's just referring to the development of purification. That.
Do you mean that they are separated? The Sila is purified, not more, or what? Or it is little by little? Let's do it with Panya.
Right, well, it has to be understood little by little, and it has to develop up until enlightenment. There can't be any purification of Sila until that level.
It depends how you use the word purification.
Right, this is what I'm questioning.
Purification doesn't necessarily mean fully purified. Even in the ordinary sense, purification can be the gradual
process. The relic.
I think
it's just put there.
It's not the real one.
It is the real one.
Is it the real one?
But it may not be the real picture.
Did anyone actually look at it and see that it was gold?
Yes.
Oh, they could see it was gold.
I mean, a lot of people saw it.
They could see that it was gold. Yeah. Yeah. You could see that it was gold at that one. And so. Okay, because someone actually asked me to check.
There are pictures which are not superimposed, which are just completely taken that way. You can.
Ivan has a comment about the relics.
I don't have a comment.
You guys are scared now.
We're talking about the relics.
All I said was, how do we know it's a relic of the Buddha? That's all. He added the words afterwards that it could be a sesame seed.
No. I heard you say that. You were the first one to bring that up.
And I think Ivan's point was, does it matter because it's a visible object anyway and there can be respect to the Buddha's qualities or attachment regardless, so does it matter anyway?
Well, we can pay respect, but we don't know if it's a relic or not, that's all.
Yes, you won't have respect if you think it's a sesame seed.
You can pay respect. You pay respect to outside here, to that relic there. You pay respect to a Buddha Rupa, so you can pay respect to that. But we just don't know if it's true or not.
Ajahn, I don't remember what was comment, but I heard, maybe it was from you or somebody else, about the difference, like here you keep the relic, as against a Buddha image, because it's different. In what sense is it different?
What do you mean?
From a Buddha image.
From a Buddha image, because some...
We have the place to keep Buddha image at all. Otherwise we'll have lots of Buddha images.
Is that the reason?
Like museum.
That's the only reason.
We do not have place to put. What would you suggest?
No, nothing. I mean, I thought I read something about why, but I forgot, that's why I'm asking again, why it's okay to have the relic, but not okay to have Buddha image.
Between the relics and the image, what would you prefer?
Of course, the relic. Why would I prefer?
Because it was once the Buddha.
It was once the Buddha.
Whereas the statue can be pumped out 1,000 at a time.
Yeah. The Buddha image, that didn't evolve until after the Buddha had died anyway. It's a new invention, really, in Theravada, isn't it? Relatively. Few hundred years after Buddha died, they started to make Buddha images.
And also, relics are mentioned in the text, but
Buddha images are not.
Buddha images are not.
Yeah. Although I think Buddhaghosa says in the commentary that the Buddha images are okay, they are acceptable, but they do acknowledge they came a bit later.
In the sutta about burning everything, burning. We read the eyes burning, the ears burning. Does it mean that these are burning because they are the condition for attachment, aversion, and so on? Because we read about the fires of lust, anger, and aversion. So they are the fuel. So the eye, the ear, are the fuel for the fires of lust, anger. So when it says that the eye, the ear are aflame, it means that they are aflame just because they are conditioned to arise, or they are aflame only when attachment, aversion arise. This is what it means. So can we say that the ayatanas themselves are burning on account of their impermanence, or can we say they're only burning on account of them, or permanence, when there is attachment towards them.
Can we say whose eyes?
Any eyes?
Buddha's eyes, Arahata eyes.
They are also, can we say they are also, well, we can say they're fuel for attachment, fuel for fires, but can we say they are burning on account of them, permanence or not, because only when there's attachment?
It depends on what one understands that. The eye burns. What?
This is what I mean. So when it says the eye is ablaze and the ear is ablaze,
when there are akusala,
citta akusala arising, yes,
just getting back to the nature of the present moment and the citta that's arising at the present moment, and how it's really very difficult to know whether it's kusala or akusala, and we understand there must be a lot of subtle akusala, but its characteristic isn't apparent to us. So is this why, to put it bluntly, it's better to stick to seeing invisible object, in the sense that is it in some way easier to directly experience the characteristic of seeing invisible object?
I think that is not the way to eliminate ignorance, trying to do this or that. But now, by hearing and thinking correctly about the characteristic of reality, which is now appearing, the sati and panya will build up little by little more understanding. Otherwise, what is thinking like that again?
I think what you're saying is that if the reflection is right reflection of some kind, then the understanding develops even though it's not apparent.
So gradually that is unknown.
And so this is why it requires so much patience and confidence in the teachings. So how then can it be verified that right understanding is in fact being developed?
From understanding, intellectual understanding, until there are conditions for awareness and right understanding of a reality by conditions. Too long to wait? Oh, it has to be this way. So one begins to understand the meaning of patience when one knows the path.
And patience is also virya.
Chetasika.
Does it mean that if one doesn't know the path, then there must be impatience?
Patience for other things, but not for the path, for developing the path. Patience can arise with lobha, dosa, even more. But we use the word virya, not patience.
We talked the other day about the Patimokkha Vinaya, and I don't know who said it, but it's actually written down here, all Patimokkha rules must be done with kusala. That's a high degree of wisdom to know that if you're following the Patimokkha rules with good, that they're kusala, doesn't necessarily mean they all have to be kusala.
You follow the Patimokkha because of what? Desire, faith, or wanting the result? Or because it's wholesome for you? Or it's Dhamma which is right?
Well, I imagine it's all of what you've mentioned. It depends on the individual who follows the Patimokkha.
And so who sees the danger of akusala will know what is opposite ways and whys for kusala citta.
Right, so somebody could go and become a monk with just desire for, well, the wrong intentions, couldn't they? Do you think?
We have to ask them, I think.
Doesn't it mean it, unless it's kusala, it's not Patimokkha?
Oh, I hadn't thought of it like that. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
If you're following rule in the Vinaya, but you're doing it so people look up to you or something, you're not really
not really following the Vinaya.
Right, no, you're not doing it properly at all, really. Mm.
But the Vinaya isn't just their rules set out, aren't they? So it's almost like, where's the difference between the rules and it's just reality is just jitter and jetta-seeker, so...
I'm not sure if this is correct, but Ajahn will help us. I think that the purpose of the Patimokkha is really directly connected to the development of understanding. The Patimokkha is there to help in development of kusala.
What is Patimokkha?
They're the rules that the monks
rules or what is wrong and what is right to do. Would we say that it's rule? Or what is wrong shouldn't be done, what is right should be developed for the sake of purification or elimination of akusala in monk's life.
So can we say that observing the Patimokkha is not a matter of following rules, but it's a matter of developing kusala?
Just follow the rules like the rules in school.
Well, what I was thinking of were the rules, the five precepts, you know, how people will take,
taught,
say they follow.
He taught monk to understand what's right and what's wrong.
Yes.
And especially in monk's life, in order to have less and less akusala, because just a little kusala will lead to great kusala, akusala.
By accumulations. Mm.
By not seeing the danger of even just very little akusala.
And I think what you mean is particularly in the monk's life, because if it is the same akusala in lay life, the effects will not be so great. Is this what
otherwise
you mean?
Otherwise, why there are monks and lay people?
Because the purpose and the results will be different, because kusala is kusala and akusala is akusala.
Both would like to eliminate akusala, mm-hmm. Both would like to understand the teachings, both would like to develop more and more kusala, but since everyone understands one's own accumulation, mm-hmm. So one knows what's good for one's life, to be monk or to be lay people. That's why those for monk, not just for ordinary people, because of the accumulation to do such things.
Do you see any value today in being in the presence of monks in particular?
When?
Anytime.
Now?
Now,
anytime. Why?
Well, this is what I wanted. A friend wrote.
I think that we should know what monk is. Otherwise.
Yeah, I think that's probably where I've got a strange idea here.
Not just yellow robe?
No, just yellow robe.
Well, in the end, the monk is the one who is following the Buddha's teachings, who is developing Satipatthana and purifying.
The
enlightened one, or the one on the way to the enlightened ones. So how would you say what a monk is? You'd just say the one following the Buddha's teachings, or
mm-hmm. Otherwise, we just speak like we don't know what we are thinking, mm-hmm. Just assuming the meaning of monk and lay people.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, some people say that a monk is the one who follows so many rules, lay people can't follow so many rules. But then they, as we were discussing, we have to understand what Patimokkha is also. So for them it's just the idea of a monk following rules, and so they are not interested in understanding at all.
Actually, the Thai do not know what monk is. Just ordination. Becoming a monk, then that person is a monk. In Thai society.
Do the monks know what a monk is?
The Thai, or anyone who just ordained.
But we could say, well, conventionally speaking, we all know that a monk is the one who has, not even conventionally speaking, you don't say, oh, the monk is the one wearing robes and who has ordained as a monk.
If the monk doesn't know that he's a monk, who knows?
Back to right understanding.
When we're in the presence of a monk, ordained monk, rather than necessarily someone who understands anything about the teaching, if we know that according to the Vinaya certain actions are inappropriate, for example certain kinds of talk or something, what is the best response? Because obviously one can't point it out or whatever. Is the best response just silence or move away? Or how do you respond if a monk talks to you about inappropriate topics or makes requests or something like this?
Do you have to speak to that person or just keep quiet?
That shows that it's very helpful for lay people to know the rules of the monks also. Mm-hmm.
That's why we have also in our discussion too.
In Thailand, they have temporary ordaining now. People ordain for 1 week or 2 months or 3 months, knowing full well that they're going to only stay temporarily and go back. Was it that way in the time of the Buddha? But they do it in Burma too. I would have thought it's wrong, but then I read a Burmese monk who said that you shouldn't even say that's wrong because there's some kusala, you know, and some of them occasionally do stay. After they intend to only stay for 3 months, some of them do end up staying all their life possibly, so we shouldn't even say that that's wrong at all, that tradition.
When one doesn't understand what monk is, so one takes someone as monk. In Thailand, I think that anyone who'd like to become monk at any time, they will come to be monk. That's it. No room, no thinking about anything at all. Mm. Just wanting to be ordained, then they ordained. No respect to the teachings, to the Buddha, because they don't know at all. But no matter you see a monk or anyone, there can be kusala citta, metta, pay respect. Like paying respect to monk in the old day to the Sangha.
Whenever we're in Bodh Gaya at the end of one of the trips in India, there's always the asking the triple gem for forgiveness, or these words that are always recited in Thai about asking for forgiveness to the Buddha, to the triple gem, and I've asked several times about it. Is there any reference to this in the text?
When you think that you have done something wrong, even knowingly or unknowingly, should you do something or leave it to anyone or to Dhamma, to the Buddha?
Well, usually we would say when we're talking about realities, well, it can just be understanding of the characteristic when it arises, and when it's gone, no need to think or dwell about it, because what about the present reality? So I wonder what the purpose is, and I also wonder whether it's just a Thai tradition or whether it's something, because I've never read any reference to it.
What do you think about forgiveness? asking for forgiveness.
Well, normally we think about it, for example, if we do something wrong to each other, then we apologize and
why
we ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
Because it's a kind of consideration. At that
can
moment.
It be the same to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha?
Well, it's something that's very unusual for us to consider. Maybe not for Thais, for them it's something very natural. But for us to consider asking the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha for forgiveness is...
Because you know that you have done something wrong.
Yes. I know the theory, but is it something in any text?
What about the apatti in Vinaya?
I'm not sure that involves asking for forgiveness.
Knowing that you will not do it again.
Yes. Yeah.
No, yes, that is easier to understand because that is seeing the harm in it and knowing that...
Resolving
not to do it again. But that seems a little different from asking forgiveness to...
It depends on the term, the word.
Okay, yeah. That is the meaning.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
But also it's conditioned. I mean, it's a conditioned response. Some people just do it. It's not like we need to do it as a ritual.
It's a kind of showing respect.
Yes.
To me, I think it's a Thai cultural tradition, but what's important is the citta and the respect
and
of that moment.
That it's culture citta, kusala citta. It's the culture of kusala citta.
Maybe.
To think in that way, to be trained in that way.
I mean, I can imagine some people who really follow the Buddha's teachings and take everything from there, means that as the guide, and they realize that they did something wrong, and who else to turn to ask for forgiveness?
When you say, isn't it the culture of kusala, well, I think it's a little bit... Like you could say, well, is the following of the precepts a culture of kusala, or is it just following tradition? And the same, if I may say it, even paying respect to the relics, who can see from moment to moment? So I think it just depends on the cittas at that moment. For many people, they may think of the Buddha as some person that can really forgive them.
Sometimes when you know that you are wrong, but you cannot ask for apology at all. But if you can, different citta, different moment. And I think that even you don't ask personally from that particular person, but when you feel like you want to ask for to know that you have done something wrong, tell that person personally, but this is not personal. But even in your mind, you can think that I know that I'm wrong, I'm sorry.
Yes, yeah. It happens, it's so common. Uh-huh.
One could say in that sense, it's a little bit like the Vinaya confession of one's akusala or something like this.
Like when you know you are wrong, but you cannot do even asking for apology. And when you can, it's different degree. Of kusala. Even you know that there is no Buddha and Dhamma and Sangha as personal, as people. Shall we change the term or the word from ask for forgiveness?
I think it should be. Yeah, forgiveness is a bit too much.
It's in English, it sounds very strange.
I have to admit our wrongdoings.
Acknowledges that error was done and maybe error won't be done again.
It's acknowledging the akusala, whereas asking for forgiveness suggests there is someone there who you are speaking to who can forgive you.
In Christianity, Jesus takes away your sins, that's it. But that's the whole concept of Christianity. Jesus forgives your sins, takes them away.
You go and ask Jesus or God for forgiveness.
Okay. And he takes it
away. I think that we follow tradition, like words and ways of speech, but when one understands it, it doesn't matter. We can follow the word, but we know that it's not the exact meaning at all. But we better change if we can, so that the other people will understand better too. the Thai language is like this, just use any term and everyone understands, so it's all right, but actually we better change to like yokjit, see, something like that, tok pawang ka jit tok pawang, they use that term, up and down for jit, yeah,
so
but we understand, pawang ka jit, like fall asleep, fall down, to be pawanga, and rise up to see and hear, see.
So what's better?
I think like as he just said, admit our wrongdoing.
Acknowledge
our wrongdoing is much better.
So we'll come together and acknowledge our
Isn't that a different meaning? It's a different meaning. Because one is still meaning. Having the Buddha, the triple gem in mind, the other one is just acknowledging to yourself.
And it's acknowledging and maybe not caring. You've got faults. That's the case.
I don't think you acknowledge.
If you can't acknowledge if you don't.
Yeah.
If you don't think it's bad.
Well, it depends on the whole context in which the words appear too, because this is part of a recitation, so. You'd have to look at the whole passage.
To me, it's all right because I like to pay homage and to ask if I do something wrong, I will not do it wrong again. With respect to the three things. Is it like paying homage to Buddha even today because he's not here now?
Yes, well, I don't think so
because the forgiveness is something that has to come from the other.
Exactly, by definition.
You know, you can't ask for
the wrong word.
You can't ask forgiveness.
It has to come back.
It's a two-way.
So it's not something from inside me. It's from something out there.
So what is better to use? Because
I think that something like admit or acknowledge before the triple gym or something like that.
Yeah, I acknowledge one's wrongdoing out of respect for the triple gem or something is okay.
Wrongdoing to the triple gems?
Not really. Out of respect
because sometimes we it seems like we insult or what?
Well, is that what's being referred to in the whole passage or is this any kind of kusala?
Well, sometimes we underestimate the teaching, so
it's just a personal comment that when we were in
it's better to change. ภาษาไทยคนไทยขอขมาเหมือนกับขอโทษค่ะ and somewhat translate ขอโทษ as to ask for forgiveness but that way
ขอโทษ is a bit different to
ใช่ค่ะ so it's alright to ขอโทษค่ะแต่เวลา ask for forgiveness ไม่เหมาะ
when you say in English ask for forgiveness it's like you're asking for the triple gem to bless you.
Yes.
So, what word should we use?
I think you, Ivan, would
just say, "I'm sorry."
We are sorry for our mistakes or our wrongdoings.
Just we acknowledge our wrongdoings or we apologize for our wrongdoings.
Okay. Apologize. So please change, and we'll follow the new one correctly. As for what?
Not ask for anything.
So
apologize for our wrongdoings.
Apologize. Please apologize for everyone. Come.
What do you? Each person is apologizing for any wrongdoing.
Just we apologize because as soon as you ask for, then it's like.
Now, what shall we do? Apologize.
We apologize for.
I mean that. Someone asked all of them to apologize. What would you say?
Oh, you request the people present to apologize.
Like extend merit or kusala that we used to say. Let us apologize or what?
Let us offer apologies for.
Okay.
I was just reminded a friend was mentioning her nightmares and
We've asked before about whether there is any wrongdoing occurring in dreams, and once I think when someone asked, you kind of laughed at it. You know, someone I think asked if there was any akusala karma pata involved when anything happened in dreams or anything was, and I think that the point was that of course there can't be akusala karma pata because deeds are not performed, although sometimes things do happen when people are in dreaming. But one can talk about kusala and akusala during dreams, can one?
There must be.
And what about, because I think in the Vinaya, when there are certain things happen during dreams or whatever, they say it's not any offence because it's during a dream and there's unknowing and this kind of thing. So there seems to be some difference in text, but what you're saying is there is kusala and akusala, but usually no akusala kamapata.
If you don't talk about nightmare, if you don't talk about dream, what about the series or the process of citta? It cannot be changed.
So why did the Buddha say, for example, to the monks that the chaitanya and their dreams doesn't count? Or is this not correct?
What about chaitanya now, in your mind?
It counts.
As karma, or as sahajata karma, or nanaknika karma?
Well, it may just be ordinary kusala or akusala chaitanya, but not kusala karma pata. Mm-hmm.
Is that wrong view, the only akusala karma pata through the mind? Or
there's one text that says if you're happy to see someone being killed, for example, that's also a kusala karma pata, I think, isn't it? I think there's a text that says if you kill someone, you can be born in a lower realm. And if you steal something, you can be born in a lower realm. But also if you approve of people killing, that can also get you born in a lower realm. Or if you approve of someone stealing.
Rejoicing in.
Yeah.
I think that we should think also about the function of karma, because it can be the chanaka karma, the one which will condition the rebirth after death, and the upatampaka karma, which it cannot do that, but it will support. But its support, it's like having part in that too.
Okay, so that level might be that type of support karma,
so
I think. You think so? Rejoicing in someone who is being killed, even though you didn't do it, that's the supporting karma rather than the actual karma.
So it's not actually the karma.
And it depends on how great it is or how weak it is.
We always say that any thoughts or intentions to reach nirvana or aim for nirvana is bound to be attachment, first of all because we don't know what nirvana is, and also it's nothing to do with present moment. What about when the Bodhisattva talked about before his enlightenment seeking nirvana?
He knows what nirvana is.
How could he know what nirvana is if it hadn't been experienced? Like we always say in development of vipassana jnanas, okay, well, certain kind of doubts may have disappeared, but there's bound to be doubt about nirvana because it hasn't yet been experienced. How could the Bodhisattva understand what nirvana is when he hasn't even developed the vipassana jnanas?
Different kind of thinking.
Because he's a bodhisattva.
It seems like we have to know what nirvana is really is, but what about the moment of citta without any akusala at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, the moment of citta without any akusala is a moment of
calm. Is it possible?
Calm,
and how to be possible? Is that what's the bodhisattva thoughts about? Well, today no one thinks like that. Oh, this is very good. What's the true nature of that which I like so much? Or just having more? Not enough.
Maybe it's the same as the question you were asking about his practice, whether it was just Silabhata Paramasa and not necessarily with wrong view. It's just something he did, being a bodhisattva, and this is Nibbana is just, it's a concept he didn't know, of course, but it's just an idea he had.
For most of us, for us, any idea of Nibbana is bound to be our kusala. Yeah. When Khunsu Chin says he understood what Nibbana is,
I think Nibbana is opposite of citta, cetasika and rupa, not condition.
I think you've said before that someone who's developed insight and is close to enlightenment would have a much better idea of Nibbana than someone who is far from enlightenment.
All right. After we have heard a lot about the characteristic of realities, at this very moment, is there awareness or attention to the nature of reality? And this could be for Buddha for quite eons and eons ago, until it's perfect, not moving away from studying, developing, understanding.
And also, if Nibbana can be viewed as being the extinction of kilesas, so when he understood the danger of kilesas to that extent, probably he had some grasp of what it might be to be without kilesas. And that was part of his, what informed him about what Nibbana might be.
I was just interested because before Khunsu Chin has suggested that at this point no vipassana jnanas have been attained, and we know that for other people, even after certain vipassana jnanas, still doubt about Nibbana because not yet experienced or not yet known. So all one can say is it must be very different.
Mm. Also, there's someone in the suttas who just heard the name Buddha, and I mean, he hadn't heard the teaching, but still he had a grasp of what it means to be a Buddha. Which
like the Thai children, like the Thai children,
mm-hmm.
paying respect as soon as they heard.
No, but in this case, it was this person who really understood what it meant.
More than just ordinary Thai children, because of accumulation.
Mm-hmm. So to come up with the idea of what a Buddha is, also for us, it would mean hearing.
Right.
You know, but
it's like Buddhism or the teachings of Buddha interest some people. Why? Just having heard that term. And for some people, no interest at all.
In the Bodhisattva's last life, before he became the Buddha, and when he went on those very austere practices, and then he decided, I'm not going to eat at all, but some dewa came and said, no, that's a silly thing to do, you'll die. It said in the book I was reading that the dewa knew that he was heading towards Buddhahood, or knew he needed to stay alive until he reached enlightenment. And then also the Brahmin Sahampati, I think, came and saw him and said, yes, please teach. So these beings must have a great amount of wisdom. If they can actually read, well, in the Brahmin's case, it was the Buddha, but in the Deva's case, he was only Bodhisattva at that stage. They could read his thoughts. So they knew what enlightenment was as well?
Yes.
According to the teachings. According to what in Tripitaka? Can we know the Deva's mind?
No. Just like I can't know the monks' mind. But they
think
were
about something that we cannot know.
No.
Try to
And they are in much higher planes. Anyway.
not understanding reality right now. Vitakka is there from seeing on different directions. Actually, I said this because it's not my nature or my accumulation to follow such things or story. What I think for myself is just reality. This moment.
This moment, yeah.
Or the understanding of the details or the depth or the subtlety of reality right now instead of thinking about those things. So I cannot answer.
I'd like to clarify something about nimitta. Talked about visible object and asanya marks, so you can remember, so there is ability to remember before. And there, I remember there's something, though I can't remember where, about the nimitta being compared to the carpenter's marks on wood. And I found this somehow at one point confusing, because the carpenter's marks are very, very simple.
That's sanya cittasika. That example is the example.
Sanya
cittasika.
Yes, sanya cittasika's, the marks of sanya cittasika were compared to the carpenter's marks. Mm-hmm. The carpenter's marks are, from my memory, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed difficult to understand why.
Like this wood is Sarah. The carpenter marks this one. Or this plank is.
I've been thinking about it more since that.
Yeah.
And now I have a different understanding of the carpenter's mark. So I'm wondering how that compares to how sanya marks. And because in wood, it's really a very complex amount of information in the way you use wood and where it came from, the different classifications of wood, how it was cut out of the log, whether it's suitable for finished product or for just rough work or for structural work. And the carpenter's mark actually classifies it and puts a lot of information, even though it's a simple mark.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm wondering if it's the mark of sanya is like a symbol, or is it like just capturing so much detail?
No.
No what?
No detail.
No detail.
Well, I would say so all the detail,
the,
marks everything about the
object. Yes, there's no detail
the,
at
each,
all in
each,
the carpenter's mark, but yet by looking at it, you know all the
all
detail.
All the detail, exactly. That was what I would
understand. But they do make the distinction between how sanya knows the object and chitta knows the object.
Okay,
chitta
so...
Chitta knows in detail.
And sanya marks it. But this is where it is also said the mark is like the carpenter's mark, and the mark of the carpenter transfers a lot of information.
All
so
the information.
All
the
information.
You have many, many marks here.
Yeah, exactly.
Many, many marks.
All
like,
the, it marks
so,
all the information. Okay.
Like wood.
Yeah.
To fit,
no,
to
I
be
have many marks or one mark that has all information?
Yeah,
no,
about,
many marks.
Many marks. About her stories, and yesterday and today, what did she say, and
so
forth.
Then it's not like the carpenter's mark.
Exactly the same.
No, not as,
that is only the example to help one to see how it marks everything, never lost. One moment of experiencing, it marks the other moment, adding
maybe
up. Each moment, there must be sanya. And sanya is not citta. And it's like a carpenter or anyone. For example, at this moment of seeing this, without marking or memory, how can there be the idea of something here? Not just one idea, many ideas too.
I'm coming to agree with Sarah.
Okay.
Like,
but then it is like the carpenter's mark.
I don't want to think about that.
I think just like the carpenter's mark.
It is.
I mean,
like
it seems like a simple mark, but it contains all that information.
Yeah, it contains a lot of information.
Yeah.
A lot of detail.
I think it's very appropriate.
And it always supports the idea of something's there. Mm-hmm. Like people in this room, but actually a moment of experiencing or knowing only an object, just an object, one object at a time. But the whole story in succession of the arising and falling away. So one lives in the world of concept with marks all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In order to see that there is no self, no one, no thing, only different realities, when citta experiences an object.
And it will be like this. It will just be like this until there is understanding.
Right. Begin to see
and
to understand.
You can't make it any different. Mm-hmm. Just
on you can. Panya develops. Otherwise, there is no understanding about the truth of realities.